Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin with you for today's edition, coming up in a few moments. The Christian view of non-violence, that was the focus of Pope Benedict's Sunday Gospel Reflections. Bringing new hope to the continent of Europe, that's the call as a meeting of Christian churches and organisations ends in Wittenberg, Germany. And keeping Bethlehem alive, that's the aim of a non-governmental organisation campaigning for a brighter future in the town of Christ's birth. Welcome to the programme. The Christian view of non-violence was at the heart of Pope Benedict's Angelus address this last Sunday before the beginning of Lent. Speaking to pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square, the Pope also made an urgent appeal for an end to the political violence in the West African nation of Guinea, where over 100 people have died and security forces have been accused of firing on unarmed protesters. My colleague Charles Collins takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Pope Benedict made an appeal for the West African nation of Guinea during his Angelus address on Sunday. The nation has been going through a political crisis for weeks and is currently under martial law.
I vescovi di quella nazione mi hanno espresso la loro apprensione.
The Pope said the bishops of that nation had expressed to him their apprehension about the current social paralysis in the nation, which is suffering general strikes and violence, which has claimed many victims. He said that in calling for respect for human and civil rights, he assures the people of his prayers so that the common good and recourse to the way of dialogue may lead to an end to the crisis. The Holy Father also spoke about Christian nonviolence, looking at the gospel for the day.
Il Vangelo di questa domenica contiene una delle parole più tipiche e forti.
He said this gospel passage is rightly considered to be the Magna Carta of Christian nonviolence, which consists not of giving in to evil, according to a false interpretation of turning the other cheek, but in responding to evil with good, and thus breaking the chains of injustice. Pope Benedict said that for Christians, nonviolence is not merely tactical behavior, but rather a personal way of being, the attitude of one who is so convinced of the love and strength of God that he's not afraid to face evil armed with just the weapons of love and truth.
In vari paesi dell'Oriente si celebra oggi il Capodanno lunare.
After reciting the Angelus, the Holy Father also sent greetings to those countries in the East celebrating the Lunar New Year. He sent those celebrating with their families the best wishes of joy and serenity. When speaking in English, he reminded Christians of the upcoming season of Lent, which begins on Wednesday.
As we prepare to enter the holy season of Lent, let us recognize our sins and weaknesses and deepen our desire to forgive and to grow in compassion.
The Pope will mark Ash Wednesday in the Roman Basilica Santa Sabina, located on the Aventine Hill.
My thanks to Charles Collins for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. As churches across the world prepare for the beginning of the Lenten season, representatives of bishops' conferences, Christian movements and ecumenical organisations across Europe have been meeting in the German town of Wittenberg, birthplace of the Reformation. The delegates from 44 nations and all different Christian traditions have been looking ahead to the third European Ecumenical Assembly to be held in Romania at the beginning of September. The four-day preparatory meeting, which ended on Sunday, focused on secularisation as a challenge for all the churches, the place of Catholic and Protestant theology in the ecumenical movement, and reconciliation as a key to Christian unity. At the end of the meeting, participants issued a letter to all Christians throughout Europe, calling on them to open their hearts to the light of Christ and bring justice and hope to the continent.
in the interest of Europe as a whole that we actually do work together and do promote the Christian gospel.
Among those addressing the meeting was Irish Father Padraig Murphy, Ecumenical Director for the Diocese of Armagh.
I think coming to a greater understanding, I think we realise with this preparation for the Third European Ecumenical Assembly, the great impetus has been actually on highlighting the fact that as churches together in Ireland, we should promote the Christian gospel, that we're living in a more secularised society, and that it's in the interest of all of us to work together to make the Christian message known.
This is a particularly challenging time, isn't it, for the churches as a whole in Ireland, coming from such a very strong faith background to suddenly a very secular society?
Yeah, I think Ireland is simply just mirroring what has happened in other parts of the world. We're not much different in that respect. We may be a step or two behind, but we tend to mirror exactly the trends that have gone on elsewhere.
You're also talking about the experience of immigration into Ireland for the first time. Ireland, of course, having been previously a country of emigration. What effect is this having on the church or on the churches?
Well, in particular, in all of the churches, like, you know, whether it's the Catholic Church or the Protestant denominations in Ireland, they've all experienced this influx of people from Europe and different than Africa. And that has had an impact on congregations. We now have a situation where in many Irish dioceses, or at least in my own archdiocese, or the own diocese that I belong to, where we've had a Polish chaplain appointed and a Lithuanian chaplain appointed in a number of dioceses. And I know in other parts of the country they have chaplains for Africans, for those from Africa. So the situation has now emerged that there's such an influx of people coming up from abroad that we find it actually that we have to address that situation. How do we care pastorally for them?
If we look back over the recent history of Ireland, of course, the churches had quite a rich and powerful experience of working together throughout the times of the Troubles, didn't they, to try and bring people together across this terrible political divide.
Well, I think in the dark days of what are euphemistically called the Troubles in Ireland, the churches were maybe beacons of light to people. People sought solace and guidance from the churches, and I think they witnessed to the fact, like, you know, that there was something better on offer. It may have taken time. Very often the conflict in Ireland, at least from those outside, traditionally had been represented as a conflict of religious conviction or a conflict of religious denominations. But really, maybe it was maybe more a conflict of political ideologies than of religious ideology. But I think the churches worked together, right back from the late 60s, worked together to try and promote understanding and mutual respect. And I think that has borne fruit, although very often, again, I don't think the churches actually have received the acknowledgement for that work.
How do you think it's possible today, though, for people within the Catholic and the Protestant tradition to draw on this experience of the past years?
Well, I think looking back, actually, they can see what the situation was like, and they can see the benefits of actually cooperating together. And I think that's important, even at times when I think secularization, of course, is facing all the churches. That's an experience that we are all encountering at the moment. But I think it's important for us to continue working together and presenting the Christian message, even in the face of criticism, in the face of a creeping secularization. It is important that we're seen to be working hand in hand.
What would you say gives you most hope in this sense at the moment?
It's very difficult, I suppose, to think of maybe individual stories, like, you know, but there was one I heard some time ago at a diocesan pastoral meeting, and a particular man commented about how when he was very young, he came from a Catholic background, and he was obliged to go to a specialized hospital in Belfast. And this is many, many years ago, before the Second Vatican Council. But his family were not very wealthy, and of course he seldom saw his parents because they just couldn't afford to go make the journey to visit him. But next to him in the bed in the hospital was a man, a young Protestant man from the Shankill Road in Belfast, whose parents would have come in regularly because they lived close to the hospital. But every time they came in, they brought something to this Catholic boy. And he said even after 65 years, he always remembered that kindness shown to him. And it spurred him on to respecting and working for respect, mutual respect among the different denominations in Ireland. And you've so many other stories like that where people, you know, who've worked and lived side by side, and they do respect each other. Like, you know, sadly, maybe the troubles highlighted more the meaning aspect of human nature. But I think, by and large, I think in Ireland, we have that experience in the past where we've worked together, and I think we can continue to do so. With greater opportunities in education the last 20 years, a lot of prejudice, I think, have gradually evaporated.
Looking at some of the other issues that you've been discussing in this preparation for the Ecumenical Assembly, I see the question of suicide and mental health issues here. Talk us a bit more through that, if you can.
Yeah, that's something which all of the churches in Ireland actually have faced. We in Ireland, I think, we have a very high rate of suicide of young male adults. And it was felt that's an issue that we needed to discuss, like, you know, pastoral approach to it, like, and so on. It's difficult. I think suicide is a very, very difficult thing. I think in all of the churches we've experienced it, it is difficult to address. We feel on the one side, it is very important to emphasize the sanctity of human life, and that human life, it's not in the gift of anybody to take their own life or to take anyone else's life. And trying to balance that, the traditional church teaching, with a pastoral approach to families who have experienced one of their members dying by suicide. And it tends to be a very harrowing experience. And I think we felt, again, like, you know, this is somewhere where the churches together can try and address the issue, or at least maybe promote a greater understanding of the sanctity of life and the importance of life. We did feel that, you know, that people maybe have despaired. Ireland, of course, has experienced phenomenal economic growth. And one of the downsides of the so-called Celtic Tiger is that many young men have despaired that if they're not measuring up or if they're not achieving wealth or position in society, that they feel that somehow they've let themselves down and let their families down. And many, some have resorted, as I said, to taking their own lives, or many resorted to other problems, like, you know, drugs and so on.
There is a very serious drug problem, isn't there? An increasingly serious drug problem amongst young people in Ireland today.
Well, particularly in the large urban areas, yeah. It's something that actually, again, it's something I think we're mirroring the problems in some other countries, some other urban areas. It is a problem, and unfortunately, I know in Northern Ireland, the perception is that maybe some people who had been involved in paramilitary activities in the past are now involved in drug dealing.
Do you feel that priests and religious lay people also are responding adequately to this, being present among the people, the most vulnerable sectors of society there?
I think by and large, yes. With the limited resources that the churches have, they have been very much at the forefront of trying to deal with these situations. But of course, then you also have medical expertise now, which, say, 20, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have had, would have been left to. People are more likely now to go to be referred to professional counsellors, whereas in former days, they may have come to discuss these things with the local priest or minister.
You're looking ahead, as I say, to this meeting in Romania. What really are your hopes, your expectations ahead of this meeting? What do you hope can come out of it?
The one thing, because, first of all, the location, the fact that it's taking place in Romania, in predominantly Orthodox country. That's the first time it has taken place. And so this, of course, is, as I say, the third European Ecumenical Assembly. 10 years ago, the assembly took place in Graz, in Austria. It's predominantly Catholic country. And the first one took place in Basel, in Switzerland, in the area of the Reformation countries. So I think we're, each venue has, is given a different experience of its own. I think Sibiu in Romania will more or less, well, for those of us who come from Western Europe, will show us something of the richness of the Orthodox churches. And maybe realize, like, you know, that we are, aside from working again, that we can work together. The fact that we are, it's in the interest of Europe as a whole, that we actually do work together and do promote the Christian gospel.
My thanks there to Father Padraig Murphy, Ecumenical Director for the Diocese of Armagh. Turning to the Middle East now, where US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been meeting with the Israeli and Palestinian leaders in the first such summit since 2003. Though no major breakthroughs had been expected, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas agreed to meet again in the near future to find ways of furthering the peace process under American leadership. Yet few Palestinians or Israelis today hold out much hope of an early resumption of peace talks that have been stalled for 6 years, or an end to the violence that continues to plague the Holy Land. Fighting between Palestinian factions has eased since a power-sharing deal was agreed between the hardline Hamas government and President Abbas's Fatah movement, yet neither Israel nor Washington seem willing to recognize a Palestinian government that does not renounce violence or agree to honor past commitments.
The problem will always remain the same for us, that Israel is a very powerful country next door. It has plans. These plans are very much not in line with us having a state, with us living in dignity here.
Leila Sansour is a Palestinian film producer and chief executive of Open Bethlehem, a non-governmental organization campaigning to keep the historic city alive, despite the increasing difficulties of life behind the Israeli security barrier. From the campaign's headquarters in Manger Square, opposite the Basilica of the Nativity, she works to promote tourism, cultural initiatives, and above all, investment in the city of her birth.
I am from Bethlehem. I spent a lot of time living in Britain and making documentary films. Because of the situation here, I decided that I want to come back and make a film about Bethlehem. And because I was away for a long time, it was an exploration for me as well. So through the film, it was a personal journey for me. And the film was a strange project in itself because it turned from a personal story into a campaign for the city. So the film started with me exploring what it means for me to come back to a city that's today under siege, a city that I knew as a happy place, and as a place that had a lot of my friends and relatives, but that today doesn't have these people anymore because most of them have immigrated. It's also a city that's surrounded by a wall. It's a prison-like environment. So to deal with all these things, I just had to think through over and over again, what is it that I want to do? Because it's very difficult to put up with this.
What kind of effect? You say that it's a prison-like conditions here in Bethlehem. What effect has this had on the local people, friends that you grow up with, many of them?
Living in a prison means that you will try to get out. Everybody is contemplating leaving because there's a sense that there's no hope to be here. There's no hope for the future, no chance to get jobs. The fact that we live in a prison-like environment means that people find it difficult to contemplate coming here. And since the city depends and survives primarily on the tourism industry, what happens is that fewer and fewer pilgrims, fewer and fewer tourists come here. I suppose the wall looks prohibitive. So although we are a friendly, nice, open culture here, the wall stops people feeling this about us. And through the campaign I'm involved in, this is particularly what we want to address, to say, please let us not allow the wall to separate us, because all it means, you just make a journey through this wall, and you are with us, and you're actually helping the city to survive. And it's a very important city in the world. It resonates with millions around the world. It means a lot to us, people who come from here. It's very hard to contemplate that this culture and traditions that survived here for millennia could just, you know, disappear because of a man-made disaster. So we are inviting people to join us in this effort to preserve the city.
What kind of reaction have you had to the campaign, and what kind of initiatives are you doing to try and promote these ideas?
We are trying to reach out to decision makers around the world to, first of all, tell our story, because we feel our story is not well told. And because often it's other people who tell it on our behalf, and it's only fair that we tell our story. So we reach out to decision makers, try and invite journalists here. We sometimes try to invite them proactively. So when people say, ask us, well, how can we support you? We often say, please sponsor a journalist from your locality, from your paper, from a main paper in your country to come over. Sponsor a trip of a politician to come and see what's happening. At the same time, we take part in travel fairs, trying to promote Bethlehem as a destination in a new way. Because historically, Bethlehem, because it is so important, because it's an iconic Christian site, people came without Bethlehem making an effort. And that means often that people here don't have the experience of how to promote their town. I mean, in a way, we just almost felt overwhelmed by the amount of people who came and didn't want more. Today, we have to make the effort to say, Bethlehem does mean a lot, and look what we have to offer. Make sure that we don't disappear.
There are still groups of pilgrims coming through here today. I mean, I wouldn't describe it as a bustling manger square, but there are still people. A little bit of business is still going on. Has it improved at all recently or not?
Maybe it's improved a little bit since 2002, when we experienced the Israeli invasion, and that was absolutely a zone that nobody would come to. So very often what we witness here is this sudden explosion of visitors for one day, for one night, and they leave. And this is the best that we get as an interaction with the word. It's just like this little door that opens once a year, and we see people, and it closes. And in this case, it's not once a year, because we have different denominations. It opens, you know, on the 24th of December, because it's the Catholic Christmas, then on the 7th, because it's the Orthodox and the Armenian. So these three times a year, we suddenly have this strange little bridge with the word.
You're talking about encouraging tourist pilgrims from all over the world. What about your closest neighbours, the Jewish population? Do any of them ever come through the wall to Bethlehem? Do you try and encourage this at all, to try and let them discover more about the Christian faith and the places here in Bethlehem?
We always welcome people coming from Israel or from Jewish people. For example, tomorrow we have a group of 40 Jewish people from the States who I'm taking on a tour. I suppose these tours are more educational. They want to understand what we think and what is it that we're experiencing. But the truth is, the problem is really not that whether we encourage Israelis or Jews to come, is that they are actually prohibited to come here by their own government. And we see it as a way of always making them unaware and incapable of understanding, really, what their country, what their government is doing to this region.
Is this a new law prohibiting them to come through the barrier, the wall?
No, it's not a new law. It's a very old law. And officially, I think it is punishable with something like 2 years in jail. But often before, people will still do it. And it was a law that wasn't used much. So people felt relaxed about still coming. And I think it became more and more severe. And also I think the idea in the minds of Israelis that it is scary to come here, it's insecure, and the Israeli government does not want you to come, became obviously more pronounced, so they don't make this journey either. So very few who feel that they don't want to live with this kind of reality where we are separated in that way still come, and we still sometimes see them, but fewer and fewer people come.
So it's a real physical and psychological barrier, isn't it, this wall just outside your gates here?
Yes. I mean, the wall very often is seen internationally by some as a barrier that separates people, which is absolutely true. It separates people in a way that will not help forge friendly relations, and so will not help forge peace. It is seen by some as a security wall. But the truth is, here we experience it most as a wall whose aim is to grab more and more territory from us. If you really are to go around Bethlehem and see how this wall is built, it is built so close to the last homes in urban areas. It actually, rather than being built on the internationally recognized borders between us and Israel, it is built around the cities, taking the last piece of agricultural land that there is, that is often owned by private people, means loss of livelihood to a lot of people, and also means the impossibility of in the future forming a Palestinian state, because everything is disjointed now. This is our main fear about this wall.
The lack of political leadership, the lack of strong leadership here in the Palestinian areas makes it very difficult to have any kind of optimism, any hope really, for any kind of solution in the near future, doesn't it?
Yes, it's very difficult. I mean, the political climate within Palestine today is very, very difficult, particularly with the sort of friction between Hamas and Fatah. It's very difficult to talk about what and when will things could be, when things could be resolved and how. But the problem will always remain the same for us, that Israel is a very powerful country next door. It has plans. These plans are very much not in line with us having a state, with us living in dignity here. For example, generation after generation of leaders actually gets assassinated. Young people end up in jail. Those who could probably lead this country end up being broken people because they spend years and years in jail. So how we come out of this, obviously, it doesn't still excuse us from trying our best to produce our own great leaders. And we should, and we hope that we still will.
You personally, how hopeful are you that you, in your lifetime, will ever see a really open Bethlehem again?
I have to be absolutely optimistic, and I absolutely have to believe that I will.
Leila Sansour, their chief executive of the non-governmental organisation Open Bethlehem. And to find out more about the campaign, you can visit their website, www.openbethlehem.org. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget you can check our website, www.vaticanradio.org, for all the latest news and feature programmes. Now stay tuned. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.